there's a fear, I think, of doing that. And then it's like, well, what is your mission? What is your purpose? And that's not the point. The point is actually breaking this American Catholic mindset that is so destructive to the church, which is you're either a conservative Catholic or you're a contemporary or progressive Catholic. And the reality is that's not what liturgy is about. That's really not what the church is about. If someone asks me if I'm Republican or Democrat, I say neither. I'm a Catholic, and that's how I form my decisions. And in the same way, that should be, I think, how churches are looking at their architecture, looking at their liturgy.
Welcome to the Beauty Avenue Podcast. Chris and Rafa here again. We have a special guest with us, Stephen Lanahan. And I guess we're sort of your guests because we're up in your territory in the Woodlands.
Yeah, thank you guys for making the trip.
Yeah, yeah, thanks for coming on the podcast.
We've taken the podcast on the road.
On the road, yeah. So we're here in the Woodlands to talk with Stephen about the really kind of your job and St. Anthony's and ways that St. Anthony's sort of embodies a lot of things that are new and different in the church. And the parish here is different in a lot of ways. In some ways, because of the size, like it's really big, and there are a lot of things going on here. So real quick, before we get into the details, can you just tell us what your job is, what your role at the church is?
Yeah, absolutely. So my I guess my official title is Director of Development and Communications. Mm-hmm. So the way I kind of describe that to people is it's everything from, you know, asking for $1 million to, you know, posting something on Facebook or Twitter. So
everything but mass and confession.
Yeah, that's right. Basically everything in between. So that's kind of sums up. And I've got a great team of people that helps me with that because we have a lot of different ways that we have to communicate. You know, the more traditional with bulletins, but then we're also doing things like podcasting and Facebook Live and trying to really up the ante there.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So, Director of Communications, what all does that involve besides just like the content that I can imagine being published?
Yeah, I mean, at a parish this size, it can be kind of daunting because you're dealing with a lot of volunteers, which is great. But we have about approximately 100 ministries on campus, and so they all communicate different ways. They all it takes
my eyes just raised.
It's a lot of different demographics, right? So you know, how does our senior pals group communicate versus our youth ministry? It's very different. And so instead of, you know, assuming, I think that the thing nowadays is that it used to be that it was just a bulletin and maybe a website, it can't just be that anymore if you want to, you know, really get your message out to the people. So we have a website, we have a mobile app that we manage, where we're, you know, doing push notifications.
Really? Yeah. Is it a custom app or is it one of the stock ones that you fill out with your content?
So it's kind of actually a mixture of both. Hmm. So we do our, it's through a company called PushPay that does our online giving.
PushPay.
Yeah. And they're just doing incredible things. They kind of started in the evangelical world and they're just now starting to crack the ice in the Catholic world. And I hope they continue to do more of it, 'cause I think that they're light years ahead of where a lot of companies are that serve the Catholic demographic. But part of their deal is that you get the online giving, but it also comes with a mobile app. Hmm. And they do that very specifically because there's a recognition of it can't just be an ask for money, but like there has to be an exchange of ideas, an exchange of prayer, an exchange of all these things. And by the way, giving's a part of that.
Sure.
And so the mobile app we design it like within their platform, but we actually own the mobile app. That's the other thing that I really like. Yeah.
Interesting.
So like if we ever, you know, decided that, you know, we're no longer going to go with PushPay for online giving, which I don't foresee that happening in the near future, but if we did, they set it up so that we retain the rights of that app and we would just kind of move it to whatever next platform we go with, which I love that.
Interesting. Like WordPress where you like have the core and you can develop on top of it because it's open source
sort
of based?
It's not in WordPress. It's again, like it's through their system, but it's kind of like it's through their framework and then, you know, but we own the rights. So like when you go to the Apple store, it doesn't show that like this is owned
by developed by that
my parish apps. Exactly. Yeah. Since it's owned by St. Anthony of Padua Catholic
That's cool.
Church.
Yeah. That's cool.
So that's been a really great thing. Mobile app, Facebook is still really big for a lot of our demographic, basically older millennials and up. That's kind of their world. And then we're trying to really kind of have a branded Instagram for our parish because we know that's going to get the younger.
Your new brand is super hot, by the way.
Thank you. Yeah, I love it. I appreciate that.
I saw the signs when we drove in, like in the parking lot and everything, down to the from the business cards, the signs outside.
On the street.
Yeah, it's great.
Thank you. Yeah, and it's funny because we worked really hard. We worked with a Catholic designer out of California to come up with that new logo.
Who did it? You can name drop if you want. Or you can skip.
No, I will. His name is Patrick Golpo.
Okay,
and,
cool.
And he actually, he's worked in the, you know, I think he like worked for Oakley and like all these big corporate, but he's passionately Catholic. Mm-hmm. He works now for Life Team, actually, international. Nice. But he kind of, we worked with him. And he was like, kind of give me the description. Because our old logo was great. We've had, this is now actually our third logo we've had. Mm-hmm. We're only 22 years old. Mm-hmm. And both of the first two logos were great. The first one was very traditional, beautiful. Yeah. It's even kind of incorporated into the pews in the church. The second one was beautiful and really had a central focus on the fact that we're very Eucharistic-centered.
Yeah. Monster and stuff.
Which was awesome. This one kind of does all of that, but we really wanted it to remind people of the church, the physical building of the church, and also still kind of have like a Eucharistic feel and highlight the fact that we're in a very unique part of Houston because we have trees.
Sure.
Right. That's what the Woodlands is known for. So, so the logo kind of incorporates it. It literally looks like the front of our building.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I see that. The like the three step thing.
Exactly. And it's also kind of meant to, you know,
elevating you to Christ.
It's elevating the cross. And then there's the trees representing the Woodlands. But then the other thing is the circle at the top that's kind of in between the two points is actually meant to represent the Eucharist being elevated at Mass.
Oh, that's cool.
So we kind of wanted to keep that Eucharistic theme in there. But the other thing about this is we really wanted something that worked with digital media.
It scales nicely.
Nicely. You don't always have to actually have the full words written out and people recognize, oh, yeah, that's the St. Anthony of Padua logo.
Yeah, yeah.
So we worked really hard on that. We're very happy with how
that's good stuff.
Out. Yeah.
Yeah, I found out recently that the when you have the exposition of the Blessed Sacrament, there's a thing that the monstrance goes on that's called a Tabor, like Mount Tabor.
Yeah.
And it's like in your logo, the church itself is like the mountain upon which the monstrance is placed.
Dang.
So it's like...
That's awesome. I'm going to start using that. Can I tell my friends?
Yeah, absolutely.
Totally intentional.
Yeah.
Totally intentional.
Yeah. So when you go, like you're going to the mountain that is like the sort of glorified Jesus.
Yeah. But that, I mean, that's ultimately, I think that's the idea with any design, right?
Yeah.
That there's
yeah.
there is some level of interpretation that can happen there. And I've heard quite a few things, like even with like the front of the church, the fact that there's three points, you know, they're like, oh, is it supposed to be like Trinitarian? Right. I'm like, sure, yes,
absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. That's great. That's
and then it also kind of echoes to our altar and our and our baptismal font, which in our church they're actually 8-sided. Here it's 6-sided because we didn't want our logo to look like a stop sign, but it still kind of these elements of that.
Stop! Don't come in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I'm trying to think what else communications wise.
Do you speak Spanish? I know you guys have a.
I do not speak it fluently, but I can translate like enough for like print material.
Oh, that's good.
And so what typically right now, because we don't have someone that does that full time on staff, I will do the initial translation and have a few Spanish speakers on staff that do other things.
Yeah.
And then I kind of pass it to them and say, is this good? And then they kind of tweak things.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That's cool.
It's a lot.
Yeah. So I know that's a whole
So you don't do anything here, right? Why do they pay you?
We've got nothing going on.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's interesting. I've never been here before. This is my first time being here in St. Anthony. I grew up on the southeast side of town, so for me the Woodlands was always like this distant land that I hear about. You know,
it's Dallas,
right? Yeah. But I've always heard about St. Anthony. In fact, we were at a parish in Dallas for an interview, and I mentioned that I was from Houston. And that I had a really positive, what's it called, youth group experience. And they were like, oh, St. Anthony. And I was like, well, it wasn't St. Anthony.
There are other churches in Houston besides St. Anthony.
So I've always, there's like this legendary status to St. Anthony. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what do you think makes this place special? You know, what is it that sets it apart so that it, you know, that it has achieved this almost legendary status?
You know, I think that we have like a... I mean, first of all, the people that built this place, the founding parishioners back in 1997 when they started meeting in a high school cafeteria, you know, this area, there wasn't much up here at that time. I mean, the Woodlands really has grown in the last 20 years, as has this parish, even to the point where, like, you know, where we're sitting right now, which is now the center of the Woodlands, was the wasn't even the center. Yeah, it was the periphery of the Woodlands. And so I think there's been just a natural growth to this area, which has been kind of cool, because you don't, you know, as much as we love tradition in the Catholic Church and history, there's also a part of it that's nice in our day and age to get to start something new.
Sure.
And so the way that I would describe our early parishioners, many of whom are still around, is they were pioneers. That, you know, they kind of, they wanted to do something different, you know, and their whole thing from the beginning was, we want to be vibrant. We want to people to feel alive when they're here, that we want people to feel part of the community. That being said, though, people are still coming in with whatever background and history they had at whatever parish they grew up at or wherever they moved from, because it's a very transient area here.
Yeah.
And so they bring some of that, some of those good ideas. They also bring some of the baggage.
Yeah.
But I think that we have a really healthy dialogue here. You know, I'll be the first to tell you, we fight a lot here internally. You know, people, that's the story no one will ever tell you in Crossing about St. Anthony's. But the outcome is always because it's a very driven community to achieve success in worshiping God and bringing people into a relationship with God, and then to serve those who are without, whether that be, you know, without physical, you know, temporal things, or without a relationship with God. And so, so there's just always been kind of this really driven attitude within the people.
Like the staff or the parishioners? Both. Or just like in general?
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and of course it fluctuates from times. I think right now we're kind of, you know, in the past few years, the discussion has been, okay, we're like 22 years old now. How do we not rest on our laurels, you know, and how do we keep being focused on not keeping up with the times, but keeping up with where Christ is calling us, and how is the Holy Spirit driving the global church, but how does that translate into our local parish? Yeah. And that is,
we totally want to talk about this. So, your church is the building. Do you know exactly how many seats it like, not temporary seats, like 1500, 1700 seats?
Yeah, I think it's just shy of 1500, but roughly.
With movable chairs and everything. Like Christmas Mass, you could like bump up into 15, maybe 1600, something.
Yeah, probably. If we added chairs like on every, against every wall, you could probably push it to that.
So it's a cruciform shape right now, and it was designed to have the ends of the transepts and maybe even the sides where like the choir is, and the other side there was no choir, expand.
Yeah.
So it's a big parish. It's a big church. It's a very big area. So the first thing that I think of when I think like growth and like what's the next thing being called to is like, what does that growth look like for a church that already
is huge.
Yeah.
And like, how do you grow in ways that are like, aren't just building new buildings and trying to like, I mean, I can see St. Anthony's get even bigger, and like, it would basically be like you in the north and St. John Vianney, like, and like the sort of western part, just like taking in everyone.
Yeah.
And it's not really growth if you just take everyone from St. Simon and Jude and from, you know, whatever, St. Matthias or whatever.
Right, yeah.
So how do you envision growth in a kind of, I'm not saying you're doing that, I'm just saying like, if the bigger a church gets, the more it's just like,
yeah, what's next?
You know? Yeah, what's next in like the best sense.
Right, and you know, Michael Gormley, as I like to refer to him as Gomer, who's on our staff. Him and I talked about this on our podcast quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is this reality that
your podcast is
Beyond
cut you
the
off.
Bulletin.
Beyond the Bulletin. Check it out. It's good stuff. We're trying not to copy everything you said.
No, <that's laughs> okay. Yeah, no, it's all good. We're trying to, we haven't recorded episodes recently, so we need to get back on it. But, you know, there's a reality historically in the United States that 100 years ago, when most of the population was up in the Northeast and the Midwest, they were building these small parishes based on immigration, right?
Yeah, they're much smaller.
Right, they're much smaller. They're on every street corner.
Community-based, a lot of times ethnically based,
right. Yeah. You had the Polish Catholic Church, the Italian Catholic Church, and the Irish Catholic Church, and they all within a mile. And there was a lot of pride around that ethnically, too, right? Mm-hmm. It was like, who can bring their traditions and make their church look the most beautiful based on, you know, where they came from. Mm-hmm. That's not really the way that the southeastern United States and Texas has grown.
Yeah.
Yes, we've had a lot of immigration here, but it's been at a different time in church history.
Yeah.
And so there's a realization as they're clustering churches and closing churches, which is very painful for Catholics in the Northeast and in Canada and places like that, that instead of building one on every street corner for the growth that we're experiencing down here. Let's build more of a regional parish, pool our resources, because mm-hmm. we don't have a convent for every parish anymore of, you know, 50 nuns that are willing to run the school and do everything and all that sort of thing. You know, so there's a reality, a practical reality of why these mega parishes are popping up in the South and in the West and, and in Texas. So that being said, you know, I met with a couple yesterday that was kind of asking us about some of our plans here for the future. And they said, you know, they had moved here from New Jersey. And they were like, is our goal to be like the biggest parish in the diocese? And I said, no, honestly, it's really, really not. Our goal is to be the most faithful parish that we can be. You know, now if that comes with numbers, great. But if God decides tomorrow, you know what, I'm going to move everyone somewhere else, then that's going to happen too. And we have to roll with that and be prepared to handle that. But in the meantime, I think it's not about, I heard this great phrase used at a conference in Dallas earlier this year, where the speaker was talking about how we're planning our churches, leadership teams at churches should be thinking about whether this is building a building or building a ministry. How am I being an architect of impact? And so when I think about like the physical buildings and the practicality behind them, you know, the people that built this parish did a lot of really great things 22 years ago. Now we're at a point where it's changed so rapidly that we're kind of reevaluating, okay, maybe we need a few new buildings. That might be part of it. But maybe we also need to repurpose the existing space to fit the needs of what's going on in the here and now.
I mean, you built 15 years ago. The reality is your buildings look like they're 15 years old or worse.
Exactly.
So if you want to be relevant, part of it is just refreshing your current stock of buildings.
And that's been a big conversation we've had as well. I think we've done a really good job, though, I think, of over the years, like, and sometimes it kind of ticks off some of our, like, ministry leaders of, like, we're really strict about certain things. Like if you notice, like, in our fellowship hall, like, there's no, like plaques all over the wall from like the Knights of Columbus or the Boy Scouts or Catholic Daughters of America. Not because we hate those groups. We actually love those groups, but like the space is used by so many people. And when you start kind of like decking it out with all this stuff, it kind of quickly
looks like your old country Casey Hall with all the doilies and stuff.
It just kind of, and there's a charm to that, I guess, in some respects, but when you think about the competition of our other, you know, Christian brothers and sisters who aren't Catholic, like it's really, we feel really responsible to be good stewards of the space here and the buildings and constantly kind of rethinking, okay, what are the little updates that we can do that just kind of spruce it up from time to time?
So what do you, let's just envision, like, let's be architects for a minute. What do you, what's like the most exciting thing for you, like the space you've been in? For like Catholic Church, non-Catholic Church, you walk in, you're like, this is, I mean, obviously, like, there's a distinction we need to make between liturgical spaces that are objectively different from light and sound smoke machines. So if we can just parse that out for a minute, let's say like pre-evangelization spaces, put it in the spectrum.
Pre-evangelization, that's a great way of putting it, pre-evangelization spaces. I mean, one of the ones that we look to here in the Woodlands that we really love is the United Methodist Church of the Woodlands, who Dr. Ed Robbs, the pastor there, they're a huge congregation.
Very familiar with them.
I think they're first or second in size in the Woodlands. And, you know, the thing, we actually went on a recent visit over there just to kind of check out, again, their liturgical space is very different than ours. When you talk about the pre-evangelization space, the first thing when you walk in that you notice is wide open hallways the whole way down. Almost like oversized hallways. And it kind of looks or feels like what you would see at a conference center. But what that automatically does is facilitates opportunity for conversation inside. And that's one of the things that we struggle with a little bit here is the fact that our buildings are separate and that they're not enclosed. And so particularly if it's raining or if it's hot, which it is a lot of the year here, people come to Mass and then they depart out the sides, you know. And that's a struggle. Even the fact that because our church is so big, we have three entrances. There's the main entrance and the two side transepts. There's a lot of people that love to just come in those side transepts
and out the door.
And I hate that because, you know, not that there's not times where you just have to do that,
yeah.
but it automatically kind of kills some of that mm-hmm. ability to just kind of gather or bump into somebody that you didn't right. know mm-hmm. went to Mass here because yeah. you can quickly get in and out of your car. Mm-hmm. So that's something that we're discussing. But I love, you know, when I walked into their that was the first thing I noticed in their building was how yeah. wide and internal the hallways were, and they connected to everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were inviting and warm in that
yeah.
way.
Yeah, it's a big trend right now architecturally, both in like generally culturally relevant buildings mm-hmm. and in educational buildings in particular, to have what are they're called like informal spaces.
Right.
So it's not a hallway. Like if you have a lot of like buildings here and other places, they're very functional. There's a double-loaded corridor, which means there's a hallway with rooms stacked along the sides, and then there's a stair at the end and a stair at the end of the hallway.
Yeah.
And it's super functional, and you're getting a good dollar per square foot, but there's no place to linger
right.
that is designed to linger mm-hmm. or to have like just some sort of informal conversation. When you have like everyone has some couches in the welcome center, which is just like another room at the front door.
Right.
But to have intentionally designed spaces for just casually being in a room that's not, you know, laying ceiling and beige walls and carpet,
right.
which is everywhere. It's not saying it's bad. It serves a purpose. I think I would say almost every parish has lots of that type of space and not the good. When I say good, I mean the spaces that are conducive to just sort of informally meeting someone and say,
yeah.
let's hang out and talk. They say, let's leave campus. Let's go to Starbucks.
Exactly.
Let's go somewhere else because that's more comfortable. It's, you know,
yeah, and that's something that we're like that's actually kind of in our master plan, as you know, is
yeah.
is to convert our current fellowship hall is also mm-hmm. shared by the school, so it's the school cafeteria most of the week,
mm-hmm.
And that's a struggle for us because as yeah. soon as you turn something into a combined space of a school,
yeah.
it's locked down for at least 5 days a week
yeah.
because of security, which obviously we want mm-hmm. our school children to be secure, but then it mm-hmm. limits the use of that space for
right.
the parish
yeah.
at large.
And the customization.
And the customization,
yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
So that's kind of in our master plan is yeah. to move that the school into a new cafeteria mm-hmm. and then convert that space into a new welcome center, particularly because of its location. It's right off of our piazza, which
sure.
leads into the entrance.
It's perfect
of our
church. For just like facilitating conversation and yeah. taking the person who hasn't been to Mass in a while.
Yep.
Just like out and into the side, and then you're
exactly
you know, having that conversation outside of the heat.
Exactly. Yeah, which
which is real. I mean,
Houston,
real. It's a real
yeah,
thing.
Houston, yeah, it's a must.
Yeah. yeah.
So that I guess in terms of pre-evangelization space, that's one that I've really liked.
Yeah.
You know, we've had the discussion about like again, not to compete with the Protestant churches, but to kind of look at what they're doing in terms of serving young families. You know. And, like, a lot of them have indoor playgrounds. And we
yeah.
looked at that and
yeah.
said, okay, is that over the top for a community like us? In some ways, on the surface, it's very quick to be like, we're a Catholic church. We don't need that. We serve the poor, right? But the reality is, like, our young families, it's a struggle to be a young family in today's society.
So I'll say there's an indoor playground at what I think is, like, Sugarland Baptist.
Sugar
it's, like,
Creek.
Down 15, Sugar Creek.
Yeah.
And my wife and I were born and raised Catholic, and we have three Catholic children that will, you know, hopefully die Catholics. We go there frequently
yep.
because it's hot as
we
all get out in the summer.
Yeah.
And there's this awesome, like, 2.5-story playground space.
Absolutely.
And imagine having, like, you know, hundreds of young families where these stay-at-home mom who has a bunch of kids and they come on. Like, we didn't engage with anyone there from the church.
Right.
But I've been on some random Baptist church, like, campus just because
yeah.
they have water fountains and indoor stuff.
Because they're serving your family.
We bring our lunch. Yeah, there's a space for us to do that. So we've had conversations with people, but I mean, I see that as a direct way to have space that during the week, if it's not used by the school, is absolutely helpful for
right.
like having us used it.
Yeah, and that's really so that we have the same conversation here. Because, again,
yeah.
going back to the Methodist Church in the Woodlands or even the Woodlands Church, which is a large non-denom mega
yeah.
parent church, they both have indoor playgrounds, and when you go there, it's the funniest thing because half the
all
people
the Catholics
are there.
Are there.
They're all Catholic.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my
they're
gosh,
the
why?
All the kids.
Yeah, why are we
so,
sitting?
No, this is perfect. You can save your donor dollars for the chapel,
yeah.
and then you can have another, I don't know, like one of Gomer's small groups. I mean, at the Baptist church.
Yeah, exactly. So we're trying to. I mean, this isn't our master plan that we're talking about with Shell Tall. Is originally the whole thing was going to be
yeah.
a welcome center, and we kind of said, hold on, this is a big footprint. What if we took a third of that and turned it into a space that really
yeah.
served families indoors? Again, because we already have two playgrounds on campus that are
yeah.
outside,
yeah.
But like again. June, July, August, and September in Houston, people don't use outdoor playgrounds as much. Why? Because their children's you know, rear ends get burned on the
slide.
Or it rains during hurricane season or whatever. So this is a real thing that, and we've prayed about it. And at first, again, we were kind of like, is this just like over the top Woodlands type stuff? Or is this something that we have a lot of young families that could really benefit their lives and facilitate, you know, that they feel comfortable being on our campus at all times. So
it's the inverse. It's the other side of the coin where you could look at like chapel veils. Like, is the chapel veil just like an overly pious thing you're doing? Like, yeah, it could be. You just like swinging the other way, but it could also be a sincere sign of devotion,
right?
Or a way that you're like, you know, it could very easily be construed as something that's counterproductive, but with the right mindset, both a playground and the church and a chapel veil.
Yeah, and I think coupled, because in the Methodist Church in the Woodlands, they coupled it with like a cafe space right next to it. Coupled with that, I think you can easily see moms going out in the middle of the day meeting for like a Bible study while their kids play. I mean, I know, you know, as a young parent, that's always the struggle is you want to get together with other men in our case or, you know, women for the mom's case to, you know, talk about faith, do a Bible study. But, of course, like having a safe place for your kids to be while you do that is sometimes a challenge.
It's confession.
And so you don't go.
It's young moms that can't go to confession. You have someone who will sit in the playground area while the mom drops her kids off the Schultz Hall.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a struggle.
Which, and you know, a great corporate model of that is Chick-fil-A, right? Like my wife
a lot of people
will
use that.
Always go to Chick-fil-A. Why? Because she's struggling with our three boys because I'm at work. And she needs to feed them, but also get their energy out. Mm-hmm. And so she will go to Chick-fil-A because literally she has had a Chick-fil-A employee walk out to her car and help her get the kids into the building, sit them down, and then get their orders and all that sort of stuff. That's the type of radical hospitality that has always been something we've strived for as a parish. We don't always hit it, but that's what the aim is.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things I heard Dr. Scott Hahn say one time, I was at a conference with him, he said, you know, a lot of times we forget that hospitality is a gift of the Holy Spirit. And that's something that we have to remember in our architecture and how we develop ministry and how we greet each other. You know, it's we obviously want everyone to be drawn into the tradition, the sacraments, the smells and the bells. But if you don't hold the door open for them when they get there, then they're never going to get in the door. And that goes for buildings, that goes, you know, and being intentional in how your parking lot is designed, your parking lot signs. And then it also goes to your digital footprint as well. That's kind of the front doorstep now for parishes.
Totally. Knowing who you are, like Chick-fil-A knows who they are so much so that they don't compete in the dollar menu game. They just don't have a dollar menu.
Right.
They're hands and feet above Burger King and McDonald's. And they have this healthy, like, wrap menu specifically targeted at. I've heard people in, like, marketing discussions talk about how a big subsection of their menu, because they know exactly who they're targeting, which a big portion of that is
moms.
Yep. Is they want to eat healthy, and they don't want to feel bad about just eating, like, chicken and french fries, because they all want chicken and french fries, but they need something else.
Right.
So it goes from...
And they're closed one day a week.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. They just don't play the game, and they're still more profitable. So they're a good example. They're easy. They're like Apple. You hold them up as, like, knowing everything. But they really do know who they are to the tune of the hospitality in the parking lot down to the things they choose to sell and how much they choose to sell it for. So they're a good example of that.
Yeah, and there's a humility to hospitality that I think sometimes we forget. Because I've heard some people almost take pride in the fact that as Catholics we don't have, like, hospitality ministries. You know, it's like, well, we don't need that. You know, people know why they're coming here, you know. But I think that that's a lack of humility that I think we're kind of missing the point, you know. That if we're able to, offer the Eucharist, which obviously that in itself is the best thing you could be offered, but with a smiling face, with someone opening the door, with someone pointing you in the right direction, and then someone saying, like, hey, I see that you're new. Welcome. Like, thanks for coming, you know. It's a game changer. I know for us, that's, you know, when we went to our parish, which is Our Lady of Walsingham, for the first time, I mean, that's what happened. People came up to us and were like, hey, we noticed that you're new, like, how's it going? Like, let me introduce myself. And honestly, I was a little weirded out because you're not used to that. Yeah. You know, you're kind of used to going in and then you leave Mass and you're kind of, no one talks to you and you just kind of keep going into the parking lot.
Yeah. Mike Gormley was telling me about a experience he had up at a church in Dallas where when he drove onto their campus, there's a sign that said, if you're new here, turn on your flashers.
Interesting.
And then if you did that, the parking lot ministry, if you want to call it that, they would then direct you to like special spots that were closest to the church. So you got the front.
They're so good at funneling that.
That's incredible.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah. But that's like, I'm trying to think in my head, I'm like, who's going to run that? You know, we always, as Catholics, we always, you know, not always, but a lot of times I see this, particularly in parish staffs, is, and I'm guilty of it, the first question is, well, who's going to do that?
That's
you
right.
know, instead who's of being like, up? I don't know, it's a good idea, throw it out there and let someone run with it.
I don't know. I mean, one of the, to like prop up your parish for a little bit, during the...
don't do that too much. We need some humility.
Well, it's part prop up and part... In the prior building campaign, there were some neighbors who had issues with the things that were being built for various reasons, and they were picketing outside. That's on the Houston Chronicle, and you can hear
let's not point people to that, but
so it's on there. I'm gonna pass on that. But the one thing that was sort of amazing that I had heard of, I hadn't seen firsthand, was that some of the youth went out there and brought them coffee and donuts, and they're like, if you're gonna pick it out here, you should at least, enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
And going out and offering someone who's protesting against what you're doing.
Yeah.
Something and just being like, hey, we're your neighbors. We want to be friends and we can do this together. I thought that was a good sign of,
That was interesting kind of handling that. I came in on the latter half of that. So I kind of, it was kind of fun to get to try and pick up and salvage the pieces of what was left of that. But, it was an interesting process because it took everything in my ounce. Like at least I had a few people that I could vent to, of my friends, but but even then, I had to be guys, we have to remember that at the end of the day, we're church, we can't go back and undo what we did, whether it was right or wrong. That can be debated until the end of the ages. We just have to move forward and try and repair the relationships. And even if we feel like we're in the right, that is an interesting thing that we kind of finally just decided internally as a leadership team. Hey, look, part of the cost of doing business in the Woodlands, whether we like it or not, as what we're considered as a commercial property, even though we're a nonprofit, is having a certain amount of trees and having a certain amount of coverage. And so if we know that the soil is not healthy in this particular area where the neighbors, are demanding trees, then we need to start budgeting for that and just plan on every year we're going to have. Because we've also had just random things. We had a few weeks ago, lightning struck a tree. Mm-hmm. Of course, it was right in that same area.
Yeah, that's a massive pine back there.
Lord, what are you doing to me? Yeah. Stop. strike on the other side of campus.
Regardless of the details, though, I guess what I want to lift up is that the intentionality wasn't we're right and we're going to take them down. Yeah. It was we got to love them. And you guys did a good job on that. So
thank you. Yeah. It was a challenge, but it was, I'm sure it's not over, but that's life. So
One interesting point, going back to the whole growth question, what do you do? You're already a large parish. Where do you go next? And in kind of going also back to learning from our Protestant brothers and sisters. So the Woodlands, for example, Woodlands Methodist Church, they're obviously a very large campus. I think it's one of the largest in the country as far as Methodist goes. And they do it very well, very successfully. I think they have three services going on at the same time on their campus. So there's a lot going on.
Wow.
But the big difference between, let's say, a Catholic church and their church is, for example, they have started a new church in the Wood Forest area.
Right.
And so they planted a church, right? And it's a new campus. And what they're doing is they're exporting all of that good culture, all of those good ideas, and putting it in a new place. In the Catholic Church, that's a little bit harder.
Yep.
St. Anthony can't just decide to start a new parish.
Right.
But I do wonder...
Although we did help Our Lady of Walsingham, the ordinariate, start a new parish up here.
That's
we're
right.
We're really excited about that.
Which is great. So, I've just had this thought of, how can we take all... parishes that are successful, St. Anthony's and others, and take the culture they have built, because you have a culture, you have a way of doing things, you have certain institutional knowledge you've acquired. How do we export that to other parishes? Because at times there seems to be such a disparity between parishes. You'll have this parish that's booming, doing great, and then you have parishes that just barely can creep up and build a building, for example.
Is it booming? First question.
Our parish?
Yeah.
I feel like it is.
Yeah. Okay.
But like I said, the thing that I'm fully aware of is at any point that could change if we rest on our laurels. And I think that one of the things that St. Anthony's has done over the years has really put a good focus on hiring.
You guys have a big staff.
We do have a big staff. And there's, you know, there's a lot of, I'm just going to say it, there's a lot of bad hiring in the Catholic Church that, that your average parishioner doesn't know.
Why is that?
I think a lot of it comes down to salaries, right? Like the average Catholic parish and what they pay, you get what you pay for. And I hate to say that because there also is an element of, you know, passion that has to be in prayer and all that sort of thing. But and part of that, but then that also goes back to the tithing, right? A parish can't afford to hire good people
if people don't tithe.
If people aren't tithing. And Catholics are notoriously bad at tithing and giving. Yeah. You know, really, like, St. Anthony's could probably be the same size as the United Methodist Church in the Woodlands if people gave with the same type of giving culture. And that's something that we're really – people are very generous here, but not everybody is generous here.
Sure.
And that's a part of our culture that we're really trying to change and kind of – we're putting a big focus on our, you know, on our millennial givers and kind of passing the torch to them. But also just what are those demographics that have never given and why are they not giving – and why is there a fear around that? And I think there's some legitimate fears, right? There's always in nonprofits and in the church, there's always been mismanagement of funds. But that's every organization, and that shouldn't deter us from giving, right? That's we give freely with no expectation back, and then we pray and kind of challenge for accountability. You know, I never want a parishioner to feel like they can't ask how funds are being used here and that sort of thing. So. I can't even remember the original question.
Where just exporting the culture here.
Oh, exporting the culture.
Just how you might
so I think
help other parishes kind of.
Well, I think that one of the things that Father Tom, our pastor, has done is he's really humble when it comes to knowing that he doesn't have to be the decision maker on everything. And he's kind of established this model that we're starting to see a lot in these mega parishes, which is the senior leadership team model. They talk a lot about this at Divine Renovation, up in Halifax, and maybe some of the other ones. You know, Amazing Parish might talk about it as well, which is, you know, the pastor can't do it all, nor should he. Because no one operating like a company that would be considered this size does it that way. So why would we expect While the pastor is ultimately like the pope of his parish in a way, that should absolutely be the case at the end of the day for most things and for morality. But at the same time, you have to empower the lay people around you to cast the vision and then stick to that vision. Repeat it, put it out there, but get buy-in. You know, one of the things that we started doing the last few years is we do a ministry leader summit every May. We do it at the end of the year because it's kind of a good, or I guess at the end of the academic year because things are kind of winding down, but we try to catch people before they go off for summer break because we know that's when they're going to be dreaming for their ministries in the fall. And so we bring together, we bring all the ministry leaders together for one day of reflection and then also big ticket items of things that we're doing that are going to have a big impact on the parish that year to clue them in because our staff is kind of moving at a fast pace every day, but to get them on board. And that's been huge for us the past few years to get that buy-in. And when we say ministry, like it's not just like the St. Anne Society of Moms, that ministry leader, the leader of the Knights of Columbus. We have people from our school staff that come to it that are administrators. You know, we have everyone that's in charge of ushers and lectors, they come. You know, it's every different aspect. They come together for one day a year to pray and to focus and then to hear the vision that the staff is trying to implement in the coming year. So, but yeah, definitely Father Tom's ability to empower the leadership team. And I would really call ourselves a team. Like, don't always get along or don't always agree on things, but there's a freedom that we can speak our piece and our pastor can hear us. In humility of, yes, we should go this way, or no, we shouldn't go this way, that sort of thing. And that's been really healthy for us. Healthy conflict, I guess.
Speak the unspoken.
Yeah.
Things. Are you, talk about that for a little bit. How does that culture actually play out? like just practically? Do you have a meeting where someone says, all right, tell me the uncomfortable things this week because I'm ready to hear them?
Yeah, so we have our senior leadership team. We have a weekly meeting. Now it's on Wednesdays. It's moved around, you know, depending on schedules. But it's made up of all of our directors. So that would be myself over development and communications, Michael Gormley, who's over adult faith evangelization type stuff. Our school principal comes to it, our facilities director, and then our executive director, who she's also over all of faith formation for like youth ministry and the younger grades and nursery. And then our pastor and our two parochial vicars. And so we come together and we sit in a room and we come up with an agenda every week beforehand so everyone can submit their items of what they want to talk about.
Yeah.
And then it's each person presents their piece and then we just kind of go into it. And I think that what I've seen in a lot of parishes is there's a very passive aggressive approach to meetings like that. Mm-hmm. And that starts, you start to see that in the way that the facilities and things are taken care of. And the general parish culture can be very passive aggressive in terms of, we just don't rock the boat. And a lot of times the parishioners don't know. They're just kind of the, unfortunately they just kind of get what's left over and the impact of that, you know? Yeah. So that's really important. And then the other thing is that our monthly staff meetings with everyone, the content and the agenda for that, I put that together on a monthly basis, is basically comes out of the four previous leadership team meetings that happened behind closed doors. And so that kind of casts the vision again.
Yeah.
So it kind of has this trickle down effect of, okay, we talk about this is important or we're not going there yet on this. And then once it's ready to go, then it goes out to the staff on a monthly basis at those meetings and kind of formulates those. And we try to balance it with the staff of not just like reporting, self-reporting on stuff, because that tends to become very redundant from year to year. We choose what gets highlighted at that, at those monthly staff meetings. And we also try to do a little bit of staff training at each one, something different, something interesting to kind of impact what they're focusing on to give them like a little nugget of this is why you're in it. This is why, this is what it's all about.
Do you find that you have to lead that and just like be the vulnerable one first, or?
Definitely at first. It was when we first started kind of doing that as the person running those meetings, I felt, because I was bringing what I had learned at other places, because I haven't always worked in the church. And so I had worked in some corporate settings that had great staff meetings like that, and I kind of took the best of what I saw other places. And so actually the one way that we start every meeting after prayer is we do a time of affirmation where I open up the floor for a few minutes for anyone on staff to share one way in which they've seen God working in the parish, a glory story, if you will, in the past month. And it's amazing what comes out of it. And that's also a great connection point, because the person that's working in IT may not understand how their work is impacting someone in youth ministry or in outreach. You know, at the last month's meeting, we had our food pantry manager, he got up and just shared the stats for the first 6 months of our fiscal year. And people are just like, there's literally been tears at staff members at hearing some of these things at a staff meeting. Which is crazy, but it, you know, and one person I'm thinking of in particular is our data manager, Tracy, who I love to death. She's on my team. And we were sharing some things at a recent staff meeting, and I look in the corner and there's Tracy like tearing up. And this is a person that literally all day looks at spreadsheets. But she's just, she's bought into the mission, and that's the thing that not every parish has, is that like your person that's dealing with spreadsheets and accounting every day should be as bought into the mission as the youth minister, as the parochial vicar, as the marriage coordinator, whatever it is. And so we've really tried to push for that in the past few years.
And that wouldn't be possible if you didn't have these meetings where you just let people kind of speak their piece. And I mean, like in a much more sort of distended way. That's me on the parish as well, because I did the drawings our office did for the food pantry.
Right.
And then, and that, you know, way before anyone knows about it, I mean, you know, like doing fundraising, you're thinking about things years and years and years before people on the inner circle know.
Right.
And then when everyone else knows later, you're like done with it. You've already been thinking about it for 5 years.
So
we do that as well in architecture, because we're involved in the very early processes of setting up, like casting vision and figuring out where the big blocks go and how to like structure really high level decisions. And the food pantry is not it will never win awards, But after Harvey, it
well, you know what's funny about that? It did win an award.
Well, I should say, it won't.
Maybe not an architectural.
It will not win design awards.
Yeah.
But hearing all the sort of the good that it was put to after Harvey.
Yeah.
I had one of those moments where I was just like, I mean, it sort of hit me.
Yeah.
You know, really hard.
Yeah. I moved to the parish like a month before Harvey hit.
Oh,
and so when I got into my position here, yeah, I kind of didn't even really know what I was doing when I got here, but then Harvey hit. And so I was like, okay, I don't know what I'm doing in the office, but by God, I'm going to get out there and serve. And so we were here. I mean, a lot of our staff, we were here the first 8 days after the storm kind of subsided. We were here from about 7 a.m. until sometimes 9 at night, 10 at night, nonstop, driving around, doing whatever we could. And it was really cool. You'll really like the story, I think. We were out there, and of course, because we weren't impacted by the flood, we were getting donations like crazy, and we were becoming kind of a place to accept things. We had a guy bring in trucks from Cleveland.
Like a hub from like all of...
Oh, yeah.
Everything coming like south from all of the United States.
Yeah, and it was nuts. And sometimes we even had to direct some of it to an even bigger place up in Conroe. But, I mean, we had trucks come from Minnesota, from California, from Cleveland, from all over the place. And what ended up happening was the food pantry that was designed to be a food pantry, that's where we put all the food, obviously, and which was really cool because we were able to actually do some things that other food pantries couldn't because we have the full walk-in
freezers
and refrigerator. Yeah. So we were able to actually like take fresh yogurt out to people that were rebuilding and gutting their houses, things like that. But then
all the classrooms, they just
all
became
the classrooms, all the classrooms that were built over there for meeting space.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where we stored all the diapers, the cleaning supplies, everything. And that's there was great. At one point where we walked into the bigger room over there and the smaller meeting room, and they were both filled literally to the ceiling, like against fire code, with diapers and everything else. And it was going out as fast as it was coming in. But the funny thing was our facilities director, Janine, walked in and she was just like, oh my gosh, she's stressing out. She's like, Stephen, the parishioners are going to be so mad. And I was like, why? And she was like, we just opened this building 6 months ago. And
we
there's,
can't use it.
There, well, no, no. She was saying there's marks all over the walls. Dents because it was served. And I stopped her and I was like, look at the picture of Mother Teresa on the wall.
Yeah.
And I was like, what do you think she'd be concerned about in this moment? Yeah. We can repaint the walls. And she like stopped and she kind of got it. She was like, you're right. I'm like, I don't care. Like we'll paint the walls later. And it just went back. Yeah. It was like, she had this moment of like, you're trying to balance like being a good steward versus like the chaos of serving in that moment. It was like, we'll figure that stuff out later. Let's get the supplies in people's hands. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. It's kind of that's one of my favorite stories from from the use of that building, which is very, utilitarian, I guess, in nature. Yeah.
I can imagine too. Janine's always so on point. She's like,
she's very direct.
Yes, I know.
So
that's awesome. Let's pivot a little bit and talk about the liturgy here at the parish.
Yeah.
And specifically ways that you see St. Anthony's opting for the beautiful over the utilitarian.
Mm. Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah.
It was interesting because I came across in our a lot of people don't know this, but we have like a fireproof room that's keeps a lot of important things for the parish, like sacramental records. But it also kind of operates as our archive for things that happened in the early days of the parish. And there was a magazine stored in there called Texas Architecture.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar.
Very familiar with it. Yeah.
Well, they did a feature on our parish back in 2003.
Awesome.
And of course, talking about Jackson Ryan Architects and just the original intention of our sanctuary. And
it was our first church we did.
Was it really? Okay.
Yeah,
I didn't realize that. That's awesome. So one of the things that it talks about is how St. Anthony's is truly a great model of how you keep the traditional side of Catholicism, but built for the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And I would agree with that. You know, I think that there's, you know, it's interesting. You talk about how we seat about 1500 people, but I've had a lot of people that walk in there and say, it doesn't seem like that. Even my brother-in-law, who's an architect in, Alabama, he like walked in the first time and he was like, wait a second, this is the big St. Anthony of Padua that I've heard about. And I was like, but
the transepts are the same length as the main aisle.
Exactly.
So,
and that's in that they featured that in the Texas Architecture magazine.
Which is uncommon.
How it's designed specifically to hold a lot of people, but to feel small, particularly if you're in that central transept.
A 500-seat church.
Exactly.
And then a 500-seat and another 500-seat
Where you church. Actually feel like it's big is if you go and stand in the corner of those side transepts.
Yeah. The photographs across the transept look way different.
Yep.
Because it's twice as long.
Yeah, because you can see 1,000 people looking that way. Yeah. So it's interesting because the first reaction of people when they walk into the thing is they're like, oh, this is not as big as I thought it's going to be. And I'm like,
well, it's also designed though with the way the front, we're talking about the logos there, like with the three sort of step backs.
Yeah.
That when you first walk in, it's kind of a domestic entrance in front of the sort of cloister. And then the narthex has a pretty low ceiling.
Yep.
And then you move in again. So it begins very sort of humble and then builds up.
Yeah, exactly. And I think though, like the way that it's designed with the 500 in each transepts and the cruciform is brilliant because for a parish this size, it actually kind of has helped to facilitate a natural communal feel when you're in there. You know, if you think about like going to a big mega parish where everyone's kind of sitting, you know, all in one nave or all in one transept, it's hard to see everyone around you. Now, I'm not, I want to be clear on this. I'm not.
Why should you see everyone around?
Yeah. And I'm not for building church in the round. I don't believe in that, but there is a way to do it. And I think you guys struck that genius here at St. Anthony's with the way you built it. It's definitely still cruciform. The focus is all on the altar and the tabernacle and the crucifix and everything that's going on up there.
Yeah.
But you did it in a way where people that maybe there's not everyone wants to be seen when they come to Mass. Some people do just want that quiet experience to sit in the back, and it lends itself to both, I guess, both, you know, type of worshiper.
And I think part of the reason why it does that well is it's a fairly dark church, and the floor is really dark, and the it's not common, I think, that buildings are as dark as this church is. I think
that's
churches
funny
are generally,
you say that, though, because a lot of people say our church is bright.
It's generally underlit relative to buildings that I've seen.
Yeah, I guess it's the natural light from the lower windows.
There's a lot of that in there.
Yeah.
It's got an inordinately, not inordinate, an unusually large amount of natural light.
Yes.
And an unusually small amount of artificial light.
That's true, because if you're at a mass that's in the evening and the sun's already down in winter
really
time,
nice, actually.
It's very cozy kind of feel in the sense that there's not a lot of that artificial light.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. So... Did you answer the beauty question?
I don't know if I did. I mean, there's so much I could go into that. I mean, I think that, you know, it's something that we're still kind of grappling with, right? Like, we actually, you know, as much as I, like, everyone wants to fight this in terms of, you know, practicality versus tradition and stuff like that, there are certain times of a year for communication standpoint where we need some sort of screen in the church, whether that's for the DSF video, that sort of thing, which is our Diocesan Services Fund video. And so this has been a big debate. So a few years ago, they added, they hung flat screen TVs in really awkward places. Our church is not really designed for screens, and that's okay.
Right. Yeah.
So one of the things that we did recently was we took down the two TVs that were added in the central transept because I was like, that's so annoying because, one, they don't really serve a good purpose, and then you're kind of well, and the first time, like you said, you walk into the church by the baptismal font, it kind of impacts the look. Like, I don't want to see screens as the first thing I see when I walk in.
Yeah.
So we took those down, and we actually added hanging projectors in the far corners of the transept. Mm. That now project onto these white spaces that were naturally already built into the architecture on either side of the altar.
Yeah.
We didn't want to add screens because when the projectors are off and not in use, we just wanted it to look as it's always looked.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've gotten pushback on it, but I honestly believe that it's the best way that you can do that without, without impacting what's already there and kind of intruding on the sensibilities of, you know, the average parishioner, I guess, and to get the TV, as many TV screens out as possible. So we have strict rules around how it's used. Before we put it out there, it was like, we made it very clear to our clergy, like, this is not going to be used as a homily crutch. Like, so don't bring in like your
clips of a movie.
clips of a movie or like, you know, your favorite comic strip or whatever you saw in Chicken Soup for the Soul. Like, we're not putting that up there.
Joe Rogan clips.
Joe Rogan, whatever it is. We're not putting that up there. The only time it's used for videos is if it's something that like directly impacts everyone in the parish or the archdiocese.
Yeah.
And then we are using it for certain masses for lyrics. But even then, there's no motion background. There's no background at all. It's literally just white words projected onto the wall because we want to honor the sacredness of the mass and kind of pointing people back to the altar.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, it's a tough nut to crack with like projectors and then having that not be the... You know, the focus, and then it's like watching TV. Yeah. It's like having your dinner with your wife, and you're looking over her shoulder at the Astros game because it's World Series tonight, and hopefully we'll win.
Luckily, my wife watches the game as well. So.
You're both.
So we're both watching. There's no talking. No.
Yeah, yeah.
That's been a project that I was very worried about, and I'm still worried about it because it's not a typical Catholic thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it can serve the liturgy even really well if done well, and I think that we found a way to do it really well, not do it all the time. Now, the flip side of that, what our parishioners don't know, unless they listen to your podcast, so I feel free sharing this because I don't know how many of them do.
Zero.
Maybe they will. But is that we are looking at, okay, we've done that, but how do we also do some things a little bit more traditional? And one of the things that was in the original design of our parish was to have things painted above the altar and above the tabernacle.
Yeah.
It was supposed to say like holy, stenciling holy, or something. Holy.
Yeah.
So we started talking about that, and we were like, what would be even more beautiful than painting holy, holy, holy is sanctus, sanctus, sanctus. And so that's one thing that we're looking at is we're trying to find an artist to paint that above that
in gold
relief. And then above the Marian altar and above the St. Anthony of Padua, we want to put Ave Maria and Ora Pro Nobis above St. Anthony.
That'd be awesome.
And we decided on Latin because we're a bilingual parish, so the easy way is to fall back on the tradition of the church.
Yeah.
And that's a way of kind of like, it's funny because it's like the people that would love that are probably super uncomfortable with projection. And we're saying, well, no, hold on. We want to do both.
That's right.
And we're
fully in both directions. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was interesting because I was just having a conversation this afternoon with our coordinator of liturgy about this because we're exploring the option of, do we want to offer a monthly mass in Latin? Do we want to offer a daily mass?
Yes, do it.
It's ad orientum.
We would kind of support that.
And so we're looking at that as an option as well. At the same time, like you don't have to kill both. You can do both and do both really, really well.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, you guys have mentioned really that. You and Gormley had talked about this on Beyond the Bulletin, how I think our generation is one that, you know, will – you know, you'll rock out to like singing, you know, Oceans or something at the same time that you want to hear Gregorian chant in mass.
Exactly.
And like, there's no such thing as too much incense.
Right.
And you have T-Swift, and both of them are, they like come together in a way that like won't work for people who like don't have a living memory of 9/11 or people who actually remember Vatican II.
Yeah.
We're like kind of in between those two.
I mean, that's the big thing this week right now. Like Kanye West just released his new album and people cannot figure out what is happening with Kanye West. And I'm not going to say that like, I pray that this conversion is real and that it lasts long, but I'm also jaded by celebrity culture. So I don't want to judge that too harshly. But I was reading an article today that was like, how is it that we've gotten to this place where Kanye's like
I know what you're talking
preaching
about.
Almost like to the level of like stuff that Benedict the 16th talked about. You know, this is wild. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting because going back to the Methodist Church in the Woodlands, I was at that same conference in Dallas. I met someone that works on their staff that was there. And she was telling me that over there for years, they've been putting this big focus on what's called the loft, which is like their contemporary worship service. So their worship services, whereas like at a Catholic church, you have more, you know, your kids mass at 9 a.m., your traditional at 11, and then you have your life teen mass or your youth mass in the evening, whatever. And we all do that in one worship space. They separate those out into completely separate worship spaces. So they have the contemporary worship space, they have the traditional, and then they have kind of the moderate in between. And what they were telling me is that they're now having to do a big focus on their traditional worship service, even to the point of like having to completely redo like their database and their communications efforts towards, because they're seeing a huge shift of millennials going towards their traditional worship service. And this isn't a mainline Protestant church. This isn't, you know, and so it was interesting to hear that even they're seeing that. And so we've now noticed like Sacred Heart and Conroe, they now have an ad orientem mass. Prince of Peace is introducing Latin mass. Yeah. And so we're now having that conversation internally here of like, we don't want to be left out on this. Like if, and we recognize it because I'll be honest, on our staff, the millennials, a lot of us really want to see a Latin mass, you know?
Yeah,
and
it
typically tends to be the baby boomers that are more against it. They're like, well, what about the guitar and, you know, being all about the people? And it's like, our faith is literally meant to be like a cross. Yes, it has to be horizontal, focused at the people in the community, but we can't lose sight of the sacred and the divine, which is oriented more vertically, looking up towards God. And you even see that in architecture in Europe, right? Mm-hmm. There's St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna, which is built in more of that Gothic, you know, vertical, God is up high, I am down low, unworthy.
Yeah.
And then you go in right around the corner in Vienna is St. Peter's Church. And you walk in there, and the first time I walked in there, there was an organist playing, and everything's gold relief and heavy and big and almost intrusive when you walk in, because it's built in the Baroque
style. Overbearingly Baroque,
Overbearingly Baroque, exactly. And there's need for both, because then you feel like God is like, oh my gosh, God is here, God is coming, like he is present. And so that's the balance that we have to strike liturgically in your average parish. And it's not easy, because everyone has what they like, and every pastor has what they like. Mm.
Do you have a scola in your parish?
No.
Mm.
No.
Not yet.
Says you need a scola.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, we have these are the areas, I would say, liturgically that we are we're working on. And, we've actually put together an internal team that our parishioners, not a lot of people know about it, actually. It's kind of a quiet little quasi-advisory council to our pastor, who I would say is more of that baby boomer generation.
Mm-hmm.
But we call ourselves Team Habakkuk.
Team Habakkuk.
Because in Habakkuk, I think it's either in chapter 1 or chapter 2, it talks about writing the vision and making it plain on paper or whatever. And so we're kind of, after each week, we are kind of meeting sporadically, but we take notes on what we feel went right and what went wrong. And then we report that back to the pastor, and this is kind of what we want to see change, or where we feel like we need to head. And it's been interesting, because I think that so it's made up of a variety of people on staff, some that you would not expect to be on a team like that.
Janine.
No, Janine's not on it.
Oh, really?
But one of her...
No, I was joking. I think
you're one of her staff members is on it.
Oh, really? Nice.
And we get together and we kind of talk about, like, hey, like a few weeks ago, we had a weekend where we just felt like we totally bombed. I mean, we had, and I would admit it, you know, there were some things that we didn't prepare for well. And I even heard some parishioners got up and walked out of Mass, which is horrible. Like, you never want to hear that.
Well,
we know we're not going to hit it perfect all the time, but we got to do our best as much as we can on Sundays, because that's our one opportunity. And so,
are you going to punt on that, or are you going to?
I'm going to leave that alone.
Okay.
It's a little bit of a sore spot.
That's
because
fine.
I feel like
safe spaces here.
Yeah.
Keep on going.
No, I mean, it's just one, I don't want to offend anybody personally,
but
it was kind of like, it wasn't any one person. It was all in this one particular Mass just kind of failed epically. And it even some people, and I'll be the first to say, it felt like a Protestant service, and people are like, what is going on? And it was, we tried to do too much. Like, we were trying to do our annual report that weekend. We were trying to introduce music. It was just a lot going on and it was too much. Like, there's something to be said for the quality of the fact that the church thinks in centuries. And so sometimes our parishioners do too. And we have to be, aware and to that sensibility of the
person. And you guys are moving 9 miles an hour, because you're spending all day, every day at work thinking about the parish. And some people may go to Mass this week.
Yeah.
And when they see it and they hit it, you're moving, like, your entire life is just on fast forward.
Yeah.
And sometimes you probably need to, tap the brakes a little bit. And then,
and I even had, a couple come in that I was talking to yesterday, and it was the same couple I was telling you about earlier from New Jersey, and they were sharing, they're like, when we first moved here, we hated this parish.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they like plainly said it. I loved it, because I've heard this before. Like, it's not the first time they said it. They're like, it took us 4 years to get to a place where we like this parish, and now we love this parish. Mm. And
what did that for me?
Well, they said they did the church shopping. They looked around elsewhere. And they kept coming back here. It just kind of kept landing back here. But they said ultimately what it came down to was joining ministries and getting to know people.
Mm.
And as soon as you get to know people and you join a Bible study, you go on a pilgrimage, you do this, you do that, well, suddenly then it's not as scary, and you feel like you can ask questions and people can explain things.
Mm.
It's when you don't get connected that you just kind of fester on something that you feel should be changed. And then we can't change it if we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one thing it seems like you do really well as a parish is not any in particular thing, but that you have what I'll call a feedback loop. Mm-hmm. And I know there are the organizations that I really admire a lot business-wise really focus on that institutionally. So there's a time for you to meet as a group and where you invite feedback and you talk about it. And that loop is something that seems like if we're talking about what can we extract from, let's say we all agree that St. Anthony's has something good going and we want to see what we can pull out. I would say one of those things is the feedback loop where you have institutionalized time to talk about this thing and you even have like Team Habakkuk.
Right.
It's like, you know, the whole point is to be like a kind of fast-forwarded feedback loop.
Right.
With a small group of people who can be a little bit more free with your, you know, a little bit more, less guarded with your speech, let's say, and whose goal is to think about things that can be changed, need to be refreshed, and instead of just like at the refresh rate of the pastor, it's more like weekly.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that's worth
highlighting. The hardest part about that, though, particularly when you talk about Sundays, is sometimes helping volunteers to get that vision or to get for them to understand the urgency of what they're doing or not doing. That can really be frustrating sometimes from a staff member. And it's tough. Like sometimes that falls on us to communicate it better.
Yeah.
But that's one of the biggest challenges is like sometimes with those liturgical volunteer positions is helping them to understand how crucial their role is.
No, but I mean, I was just going to say that I think that there's a desire, and I don't know where it originated, but for Mass at a parish to be the same across all masses, you know, to be like this unifying thing, which makes some sense. But at the same time, I do wonder if there is a place like St. Anthony where you could have the Latin Mass.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and then other masses that are, you know, not to say that you need to have masses be completely different where this one's like super contemporary, this one's not, but that there maybe is room for some variety.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things we're talking about as we're kind of pitching this idea of an ad orientem daily Mass and then maybe a Latin Mass once a month starting out, you know.
Sure,
baby steps is other.
Absolutely. Other I think that's the right way to do it.
But one of the things that we're talking about with this is that the Roman Missal allows for a lot.
Right.
It allows for the Latin Mass. It also allows for a guitar at Mass. So what's wrong with offering all of it? And not to say that we're, you know, there's a fear, I think, of doing that. And then it's like, well, what is your mission? What is your purpose? And that's not the point. The point is actually breaking this American Catholic mindset that is so destructive to the church, which is you're either a conservative Catholic or you're a contemporary or progressive Catholic. And the reality is that's not what liturgy is about. That's really not what the church is about. If someone asks me if I'm Republican or Democrat, I say neither. I'm a Catholic, and that's how I form my decisions. And in the same way, that should be, I think, how churches are looking at their architecture, looking at their liturgy. I should not be hardline, you know, one way or the other. And I've had a lot of experiences with that in my own life from a young age, actually, kind of uniquely. I went to a parish that was kind of similar to St. Anthony's, not quite as big. Where it was very traditional in terms of love of the devotions and the sacraments, but we had a life team Mass. And I remember in middle school, I went to a summer camp with FSSP. So every day I'm at this Catholic summer camp having Latin Mass. And everyone, you know, all the seminarians, all the priests, they're all in cassocks, the whole thing. And I loved that. And it was such a rich experience. But one of the things I remember at that summer camp was getting in these arguments with these hardliner seminarians for that order who were saying things like that no Mass is valid if it's a quote unquote life teen Mass. And not to say that there haven't been weird things done in the name of life teen. I've worked for life teen. And so we know some of the history. There are things that have been done in the name of life teen that aren't actually the mission of life teen. But that was such a turnoff for me. I'm like, I don't understand how you're going to dictate that this is the only way for someone to get to God or to have a relationship with Christ when the church has said that both of these are within context and both should be done well. I'll be the first to tell you, I hate going to a contemporary Mass that is done poorly. I also hate going to a traditional Latin Mass where if my wife doesn't have a chapel veil on or, you know, or
if you don't have a chapel veil on, look at you, terrible.
Yeah, whatever. Like, that's just gross. Like, that, there's no place for that or time for that. Like, we have bigger fish to fry in the church. And the best place you can see these arguments, if you really want to go down a rabbit hole, is Catholic Twitter. Catholic Twitter, I don't know if you guys have experienced it.
It's a crazy thing.
Twitter, general assessment.
Catholic Twitter is like uniquely
It's uniquely awful.
Bizarre.
There's been so many great things that happened there, but I'm like, literally, like the people that we should be evangelizing to, if I were a non-Catholic looking at that,
man,
I would be so turned off. It's just people get into these things and it's like, this is the hill you're going to die on.
Catholic Twitter is like walking on the edge. Like, I'll follow someone and like, oh, all this good stuff. And then like over, like instantaneously, there's something that just blows up and people are like, this is why I hate Twitter and I'm never getting on again.
Yeah. But you know what the good thing about it is? If there's one good thing, it's exposing the reality of what happens behind, what's happened for decades behind closed doors and behind emails and behind angry phone calls at parishes around.
It exposes the heart. It really
sure does.
It's like there is no, we're not face to face. So I can do this thing, you know, across the country.
Yeah.
And you see the trueness behind
it. You do. There's a benefit to that, but it's also kind of heartbreaking when you see it. You're like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's a good thing. It's definitely a bad thing. It's absolutely heartbreaking.
No, I think that's such an important point because, like, I feel like what we have the danger of is that you end up creating these Catholic ghettos where you practice your version of Catholicism and I practice my version of Catholicism. But the problem is that Catholicism is supposed to be all-encompassing. And a unifying thing, you know. So, like, Pope Benedict, you know, writes Summorum Pontificum, which allows the celebration of Latin Mass, which I think is a great thing. But unfortunately, one of the things that I think is still not being done very well is what he called the mutual enrichment of the two rites. What you're seeing is parishes that do exclusively the extraordinary form or parishes that don't do it. I think where the church can really grow is in parishes that do both. And where there actually can be learning and enriching between the two parties, you know. But unfortunately, you just don't see that very much. A few parishes are doing it, but not
many. We're going to be the next. We're trying. That's our goal.
Man, if Prince of Peace beat you there, you're like...
Oh, whatever. I know. We love Prince of Peace. We actually meet with their staff a lot to kind of compare notes. Yeah.
Nice.
There's been kind of an interesting thing with these, like, mega parishes. Because, like, we don't feel like sometimes we can connect even with, like, the parish maybe down the road or the next town over. Like, we connect a lot with Prince of Peace and their staff. And then we connect a lot with St. Anne's in Coppell, Texas.
Oh, cool.
They're huge. Oh, my gosh. They're such a big
a lot of, like, crossover.
Yeah, just it's kind of like, what are you guys doing? What can we be doing? And we swap ideas.
That's great.
Because this like, mega parish thing is new. Like, it's a new threshold that we're crossing in the Catholic world, and we're trying to figure it out as we go.
When I first got involved in Catholic creative stuff, they were like, oh, you know Gormley?
Yeah.
He's like the Houston.
Yeah. I was actually just with some of the guys from Sherwood Fellows last week.
Oh, great.
Because they're kind of helping us with a lot of our marketing for our upcoming campaign.
Yeah, that's cool.
I do also appreciate that you guys are being sensitive about introducing this stuff because, like you said, people kind of get a little freaked out when you change things.
Yeah, we're trying. It's weird, too. Like, that's what I'm saying. We had this one mass where we felt like I was just like, oh, man, we didn't do that well. So we know, like, we're not always going to do it perfect, but you take it so hard when you work in the church. And we were talking about that this morning, actually. Like, we need to have tougher skin sometimes, but still not lose that healthy balance because you know that, like, you're impacting someone's faith life, which is one of the most intimate parts of their life.
Right.
And so if you get it wrong, it really impacts people in a big way. And so it's pray for people that work in parishes because it's a constant battle.
Well, and the catechesis that has to go along changes in the liturgy, especially because if you just show up on Sunday and everything's different, you're like, wait, what's going on?
Right.
Like, did I show up to the wrong church? But so talking about this phenomenon, if you will, of the big parish, the mega parish, do you think that's the future of the Catholic Church? I mean, as we continue to face all these issues that we're facing, shortage of priests, etc., is that where we're going, or do you see us going back to the smaller parish model?
Oh, boy. I think it's a little bit of a both and I know that's a terrible answer. You know, would I love a Catholic church on every street corner that seats 200 people? Hands down, yes. That would be amazing. Is that going to happen? No. So we have, now, unlike the Ordinariate, right? Like they're kind of doing that because that's, but that's very different. That's people that are converting from Anglicanism, which
it's
is
a very specific thing.
Yeah. Yes. So, so in the general, you know, Latin rite, no, I don't think that we're going to see it go back to that. What we've got to do, and we've tried and we've seen success here, but we still haven't perfected it here, is adopting what, so protecting the liturgy, like we've talked about, and finding that enrichment across all boards there. And then really looking at what they're doing again, and in the evangelical Protestant model of the small community group model, and figuring out how do you take that and implement it into the Catholic setting. And I think we do that really good through things like the ACTS retreats, through some of our outreach programs. You know, we have a lot of pilgrimages that we do. I think there's a definite benefit anytime you offer something where your parishioners are traveling together to have an experience. It goes back to that idea of being an architect of impact. You're literally creating spaces for interactions and community to happen.
Right.
And that's got to be the key in our architecture. Because we can't go back to the small parish on every street corner, a welcome center should be a prime focus for a parish. Because you've got to create, and not just a utilitarian space that looks like a cafeteria. I'm talking about a real, warm, beautiful space that facilitates this idea of community and Catholic beauty all in one.
I can already hear, you said something a couple minutes ago that I just want to grab. I'm reaching like into the timeline of this podcast because I can tell that when you said we want to take some Protestant ideas and bring them into the Catholic Church,
yeah.
What I heard you say, and this is what I think you said, is that there are some ideas about meeting people where they're at and evangelization of
yeah.
those people and liturgy, and you want to take both of those knobs and turn them up 200%.
Bingo.
So it's not
Bingo.
One or the other. Liturgy yeah. revolution will yeah. not save the day, and just evangelizing without returning to something that we have lost in the liturgy.
Yep.
Neither of those by themselves will do the thing.
That's just it.
Pope Benedict says liturgy presupposes evangelization, and if you haven't done that,
yeah, I'm kind of in that sense. I'm a glass twice as full kind of guy.
Yeah.
I don't want to eliminate one or the other. I want to do both, and I want to do
yeah.
both big.
And I heard you say that, but I just want to.
Oh yeah, reiterate.
There are people
yeah.
who will be like, yeah,
yeah.
What
no,
are you saying?
I'm not. I'm definitely not saying like we need to do everything. That
play
the,
place.
That,
we're done.
Yeah. I'm not saying that I want to do everything that the Methodist Church or that the non-denom or whoever down the street is
yeah,
doing. Absolutely
yeah.
not. I am 100% Catholic. Never want to change that.
Yeah.
All that sort of thing. You know, I can't wait until Pope Benedict becomes a doctor of the church. I'm waiting on the day. But I do think that there are elements of our other Christian brothers and sisters that
yeah.
can help us. And, you know, I think a great example of that would be how we do youth ministry now in the Catholic mm-hmm. Church. We've always been about 20 years behind on youth ministry in the Catholic Church mm-hmm. Until recently. Now I feel like we've kind of caught on to
that
culture
yeah.
Of reaching out to people and meeting people mm-hmm. where they're at. Now we've got now we're seeing it in college ministry with things like Focus
yeah.
and mm-hmm. all these other things. We've got to keep broadening those ministries across all age demographics
yeah.
and make sure that it's reaching everybody. And I think you do that through the tradition, but through evangelization as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I got a lightning round we can end with.
All right, let's do it.
Okay, answer these guys, and we probably won't follow up if with your answers.
Okay.
Unless they're really interesting. I'd be like, stop, question one.
You can come back, or I'll come down to where y'all are.
Yeah,
you know.
So if you had one piece of advice for a person in your field, say they're early in their career, and define your field however you want, what would you say to them?
Don't be afraid to think really big, whether that's in development or communications. You know, when we launched a podcast for our parish, I don't know of any other parish around here that does a podcast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But man, we saw wild success with that, and
really?
We want to keep doing that.
What are your stats like?
You know, I haven't looked at them recently, to be honest, but I know like we were averaging, I think like 1,000 downloads an episode.
That's good.
Starting out, which
yeah.
for a parish,
that's
huge.
Amazing.
Yeah.
yeah.
Like I don't need to reach,
it's not catching Fox's level, but
it's not catching
Fox's
level,
we'll
but, let's not stroke Gomer's ego too much. So, so that kind of thing,
it's just like, Gomer doesn't do anything.
Yeah. And then also like, don't be afraid to push your parishioners. Like, particularly when it comes to technology, like, you still want to serve the older demographic, But man, you got to be thinking, because the church is so behind. Like, we're the church in general is so far behind. I'm like, we use Slack at our parish. Mm-hmm. If you're not using Slack at your parish as a healthy way to interact as a staff, mm-hmm. you need to be using Slack. Budget it and make it happen. Everyone mm-hmm. else in the world is using tools like this. Mm-hmm. You know, stuff like that is really going to improve where you're thinking. You know, your classroom space, your meeting space. Don't be afraid to think out of the box. Make that usable for everybody. So, sorry, that was not a lightning round answer.
Lots of lightning. I'm burned to a crisp. What, if anything, do you wish you had done differently in your late teens, 20s, 30s?
Oh, boy, that's a loaded question.
Yeah.
In my late teens and 20s.
Pass is an acceptable answer.
I really feel good about how I lived that part of my life, to be honest. So I'm just going to pass. I don't really have any regrets.
Great. 10 years from now, what do you think you will regret doing too much of or too little of in life?
Particularly working in a parish, I feel like I'm going to regret how much I worried about things that don't matter. Hmm.
What is something you're right about that is very controversial?
Everything we've talked about on this podcast.
Except for that thing that you passed on.
No. I think that I am right about most communications things in our parish, and I get a lot of pushback sometimes, but it is what it is.
What book should everybody read?
Every man should read Father by God by John Eldridge. Everyone in development should read The Spirituality of Fundraising by Henry Nouwen. Mm.
What negative experience, one you would not wish to repeat, has profoundly changed you for the better?
Negative experience. I would say probably dealing with the neighbors here at the parish. I don't want to do it again, but I've learned a lot through that process of what not to do or how to approach things.
If you could solve one mystery as a scientist, journalist, artist, theorist of any sort, what would it be? Writer, fundraiser.
If I could solve one thing, I would probably solve all the liturgical and theological things that we can't seem to figure out as a church. I'd get everybody on the same page.
If you could resurrect one person and give them the benefit of modern education so that they may overcome things that they would otherwise obviously have done if they were born now, who would it be?
St. Francis. Mm. I'd want to know how he would apply his life back then to today.
If you were in a position to recreate the T-Rex, would you do it?
To recreate it?
The Jurassic Park question. If you found...
Well, you said recreate, so if I get to recreate, like, I could make his arms longer.
You can take the question that way if you'd like.
No, I would not. I would not do that.
Okay, and the ultimate question. If you were in a position to annihilate the mosquito, would you do it?
Hands down, yes. Like, is that even, why is that even a question? Of course. Awesome. We live in Houston.
I know, right?
Absolutely.
Especially in Houston. That's why we can't have anything outside.
That's right.
And
apart from the heat.
For the guests who are listening to this, say they're a seminary or a parishioner, what's one thing you wish that they would know that you think they don't already know?
I wish they knew how much our staff and our clergy, although we make tons of mistakes, are sacrificing for them on a daily basis. I think some of them know it, and not in a boo-hoo way, but like, everyone that works here truly loves this parish and truly wants it to be. And I can't say that about other parishes I've been to or seen or witnessed, but truly, I would say 9 times out of 10, the people that work here love this place and consider it home. Even the ones that aren't Catholic, we have non-Catholics on staff, but they love this place and they want to see it be top notch all the time.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming on.
Great. Yeah, thanks for coming.
Thanks
on the podcast.
For having me. Sorry. Yeah. I hope I didn't tick off any of your viewers.
No, I hope
no,
you did.
No, you're totally good.
If you didn't, we're doing something wrong.
There you go.
Awesome.
Thanks. Great.